It turns out the names of the jurors from the Bill Cosby trial are being released. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. This afternoon, Montgomery County Judge Stephen O'Neill approved a request from several media organizations, including WHYY, to release the names. County prosecutors and defense lawyers told O'Neill that publicly identifying members of the deadlocked jury could discourage others from serving when the case is retried later this year. They say that would undermine Cosby's right to a fair trial. Though O'Neill says the jurors are now private citizens, and they can make up their own minds about whether to talk to the press. In a letter to jurors, the judge told them they can speak about what they thought or how they voted individually, but that anything else that happened or was said during deliberations should stay confidential. Philadelphia has a new initiative designed to offer cash instead of tax credits to city businesses that hire applicants with criminal records. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that Mayor Jim Kenney is urging businesses to take advantage of it.
There's a lot of smart, decent people there who took a wrong turn, maybe can't make bail. I don't feel afraid when I'm in there.
Mayor Jim Kenney spoke from the heart during the introduction of the new Fair Chance Initiative. It gives employers direct cash reimbursements instead of tax credits for hiring those who have spent time behind bars.
The people that I've been able to place personally, whether it's a labor union or whether it's a private business, those folks are the best employees that union or that company has, because they recognize the chance that was given to them again to fulfill that, to fulfill an opportunity to make sure that their families are taken care of, that they can buy a house, raise their children. And that's all really anybody wants.
Prisons Commissioner Blanche Carney says the goal is to break barriers.
To remove stumbling blocks so that folks don't serve a life sentence for a county sentence, that they can actively engage as active, productive citizens the same way we do when we go to work every day.
Bob Logue is co-owner of Quaker City Coffee and frequently hires people who have gone to jail or prison. He says it will have a domino effect if more employers follow suit.
The neighborhoods that we grew up in possibly now stand a chance of having some families with fathers and mothers who have strong jobs, with living wages, with benefits, and the opportunity then to pass that on down to the rest of their community.
The program provides a $5 per hour rebate for up to 1,000 hours a year per person hired. It's only open to those earning more than $12 an hour, what the city considers a living wage. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia Daily News Toxic City series this week focused on lead-poisoned soil in the River Ward neighborhoods that once were home to 14 lead smelters. I interviewed reporters Barbara Laker and Wendy Ruderman about the scope of their investigative study. They got input in part from Philadelphia Health Commissioner Dr. Thomas Farley, who joins me now with additional perspective. Dr. Farley, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for giving me a chance.
To what extent do you agree or not that there is a correlation between the quantity and the proximity of the former lead smelters to incidents of lead poisoning now?
Well, certainly that article was pretty frightening. I think any parent looking at that would be concerned that any child living in Fishtown is likely to get lead poisoned. Fortunately, we have some information and some data to bear on that question of risk, because 90% of the children in Philadelphia are tested for lead, and we know their address, and so we can actually draw a map that shows lead poisoning rates by neighborhood. And what it shows is that there are higher levels of lead in neighborhoods that are older and neighborhoods that have high rates of poverty, but that the higher lead levels don't correlate at all with the sites that have the former smelters.
Though clearly there's some overlap. Some of those older, more impoverished neighborhoods were in proximity to lead smelters.
There is some overlap, but it's not associated as an overall pattern. And that doesn't say that no child is getting lead exposure from the smelter area, but it does say that probably the primary source for lead for children in the city is paint on the walls, and that's something that we've known about for a long time, which we haven't solved that problem. We're still working on it. So it is worth putting in some perspective that if you were a parent, even in those neighborhoods, and you're worried about protecting your child from the lead, the first thing you ought to worry about is the paint on the walls, more so than the dirt outside.
I think most would agree with that prioritization, yet three-quarters of the 114 soil samples that this investigative team brought back for analysis did find levels of lead in the soil.
Yeah, lead is in the soil in those neighborhoods. Lead is likely to be in the soil in every other neighborhood in Philadelphia. And here's the reason, is that for decades, paint had very high levels of lead in it, including exterior paint on houses. And so as that exterior paint deteriorated, that washed off into the soil around the house. And also lead was put in gasoline for decades, and that settled out over the entire city. And so if you test soil in really any urban, older urban neighborhood in this country, you're going to find an awful lot of lead in it. There, you know, one study said that nationally, if a house was built before 1940, about you have a 30% chance of having a lead level above the threshold if you test that soil. So, you know, that is definitely a theoretical concern, not just in these neighborhoods but citywide. But again, it's probably not the primary concern.
Though in these specific neighborhoods, Fishtown, Kensington, Port Richmond, a lot of construction is taking place. And so what safeguards are there for residents where that soil is being tossed?
Yeah, so that, the report raised a legitimate concern about stirring up of lead when you're either tearing down an existing structure, an older house, or if you're digging into soil that might have lead in it. It's worth backing up, though, and think, what are we going to do with the legacy of all the lead on the walls in this entire city? So over the long term, actually removing older houses is the best solution, so we don't have that continuing risk. That doesn't mean, though, that we should ignore the risk during the time of demolition. So we would like contractors to, when they are demolishing a house that has lead on the walls, which is most of the houses in the city, to take various steps to suppress dust. That's basically like spraying it with water, wetting it so that the dust isn't kicked up when they tear down the house. As far as the and there are regulations about that. Now, we're going to look at, should we tighten up those regulations and should we tighten up enforcement of that? So that those are legitimate questions. As far as digging in the soil, it's also worth noting that the lead generally layers out in the first couple of inches in the soil. So if you're digging down 6-8 feet for a foundation, you're not necessarily getting higher levels of lead there. And in fact, you may be turning over the soil and doing a favor and getting the lead more deeper. Just yesterday, Mayor Kenney and myself and others released the recommendations of the Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Advisory Group. And they made a number of recommendations. The most important of those, I think, was a requirement that they're recommending that now, this requirement that landlords test and certify all properties as being lead-free or lead-safe.
Much like they would with radon, termites, other required inspections.
Right. And they need to have it tested and certified and send the certification to the health department. Lead-safe means that although there may be lead on the walls, that lead has not gotten into dust on the floors where a child can access it. And it's if you paint walls, keep the paint intact, it can definitely be lead-safe. It'll only be that certification is only good for 2 years because it can deteriorate over time. Lead-free means this is a new unit that was built since 1978. There's no lead in the first place.
Does the regulation thereby compel biannual certification?
Yeah, the certification needs to be updated every 2 years. Right now, that requirement exists for properties where children under the age of 6 live, but it doesn't exist for every property.
Dr. Farley, thanks for joining us to offer a perspective on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Philadelphia Health Commissioner Dr. Thomas Farley. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org, where we'll also have a map showing the city, the location of former lead smelters, and concentrations of lead poisoning by neighborhood. Today is National Ask Day, part of a campaign urging parents to prevent tragedy by simply asking, is there an unlocked gun in your home? WHYY's Anne Hoffman reports.
It may seem awkward at first, but advocates say asking about unlocked guns should become a common practice, considering that 1 in 3 homes with children has guns.
So just like you would ask when your child's going over someone's house if they have pets that your child may be allergic to, they want you to ask about guns.
That's Denise Salerno, a professor of clinical pediatrics at Temple.
You know, what happens is people have guns in their household thinking that they're going to protect themselves.
But when people have guns for self-protection, she says they may not lock them, thinking they might need to use the gun quickly one day for self-defense. and most kids know where the guns are in their house. According to the CDC, playing with a gun was the most common circumstance surrounding unintentional firearm deaths of children, accounting for 6% of them. The campaign says that if a parent has an unlocked gun, then the other parent has options. They can ask to move the playdate to their house or ask that the other parent lock and store their gun safely before their child comes over. The campaign has traditionally focused on parents, but this year it's inviting pediatricians to talk with patients, says Shira Goodman, executive director of Ceasefire Pennsylvania. Her organization, one of hundreds partnering with the campaign, is working with the Philadelphia Sheriff's Department and Temple to distribute gun locks.
They're given out in emergency rooms at Temple with no questions. No questions about, you know, is this a legal gun? Is this not a legal gun?
And right now is a good time to get serious about the issue because kids are going to have a lot more unsupervised time at home during the summer. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
The Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania has endeavored since 1951 to bolster long-term recovery outcomes for those in need. A newly announced name change to Mental Health Partnership speaks in part to its expanded reach and ambition. Joining me in conversation is Michael Brody, President and CEO of Mental Health Partnerships. Michael, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Dave, thanks for asking me to be part of this.
What's the ambition now?
Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania, while having a long and rich history in this region, really identified us as a local regional provider, and we're much more than that now. We are in Delaware at the present time. We are developing some strategic partnerships in Southwest New Jersey. We have about 230 full and part-time staff. About 50% of those folks are either people with what we describe as a lived condition, so they have a behavioral health condition or diagnosis themselves, or they are a family member of somebody who has a behavioral health condition. Last year, we served well over 7,000 people within the region.
Where does the funding come from?
The vast majority of our funding comes to our counties, which receives funding from the state. So we are program funded. And then we also do Medicaid fee-for-service. And we are also very fortunate to have had recently some substance abuse and mental health service administration grants that piloted some programs that fortunately Philadelphia has picked up because they saw the value of it in terms of mobile outreach to people experiencing homelessness with our peer support staff. So we cobble together funding from all over and wherever we can.
The mission remains the same, focusing on peer relationships?
Absolutely. And I think one of the best things about our relaunch and our rebrand was to reaffirm that peer support and the idea of mutual self-help is the hallmark of what we do and what we believe in most wholeheartedly.
You've not been there since the advent in 51, though you have decades of experience. And I'm wondering how 10 years early on in the 80s at a mental health psychiatric center in Connecticut informed your work now?
So I've been doing work in large institutions, in large settings, and feeling rather frustrated that we continued to see the same people with the same conditions over and over again, and began to explore what peer support was and became very, very energized by the notions that people can and do recover from behavioral health conditions, go on to have extremely fulfilling lives and work, family, have much to contribute to their fellow peers. And the latest pieces of work we did is in an area called self-directed care, where people are able to take dollars that have been assigned to what are typically behavioral health services, mental health clinics, case management services, day programs, and redirect that money to what they feel are more meaningful activities, taking an exercise class, getting a car so that they can get a job, getting some clothing that will enable them to go for an interview and be more presentable. And the results of that have been pretty remarkable. We were very fortunate that at the time, Police Commissioner Ramsey was very attuned to trauma and behavioral health issues as it related not just to the community, but as a police force, and was very open to the idea of crisis intervention training for his police officers such that they would know how to intervene more thoughtfully and better with people they encountered on the streets with behavioral health conditions.
So when it becomes a police matter and then enters the court system, we are seeing the potential for a reversal of what was a trend toward eliminating mandatory minimum sentences. What are the implications if Attorney Jeff Sessions is able to reinstitute that, especially for those convicted of drug offenses?
I will say the mandatory minimum sentences don't work for the level of criminality that he's trying to address. Although prisons do try to provide treatment, they do not get the kind of treatment that is most helpful for them in terms of moving on in their life, dealing with their drug addiction or their behavioral health condition.
Also, there's a federal proposal. Part of replacing the Affordable Care Act is a notion to eliminate the requirement that Medicaid cover basic mental health and addiction services in states that expand it.
Something that we call the Unhealthy Care Act. Over 900,000 citizens in Pennsylvania are insured now as a result of the Affordable Care Act. If one in five people have a behavioral health condition, that means somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 to 200,000 of those people have a behavioral health condition that they now have insurance to get access for treatment. That will all go away.
From the Mental Health Partnership website, there was an estimate that the indirect cost of mental illness is in the tens of billions of dollars, I think near $80 billion.
Correct. We talk about our work first from the human perspective, but there is also a very cost-effective perspective to look at in terms of peer support in regard to not just the cost of providing the services, but also avoiding certain costs, unnecessary costs that accrue because people don't have the appropriate services or access to the services.
Michael Brody, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you, Dave. My pleasure.
Michael Brody, President and CEO of Mental Health Partnerships. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Today's the last day of school for Philadelphia's teachers. It's also the final day for Dorina Morrow's career. After 42 years and thousands of rehearsals, the longtime choral director at the Philadelphia High School for the Creative and Performing Arts is stepping down. More from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
How many times has Dorina Morrow led students through their vocal warm-ups? 1,000? 10,000? Put it this way, she's led a lot of them since the day 42 years ago she first stepped into a public school classroom in Philadelphia.
I was so excited. And I came into school dressed with, like, stiletto heels. I still remember the dress. Black with, like, red, blue, and yellow piping on the sleeve. And I walked in, and all the other veteran teachers had, like, gym shorts on and flip-flops because they knew they were going to work that day. I was like, oh, well, I'm a teacher. I have to dress appropriately.
Morrow took teaching seriously because, as she puts it, she's always been a teacher. It's been her destiny ever since she was a student herself at a small Catholic school outside Pittsburgh.
And the nuns there, Sisters of St. Joseph, grabbed me and they said, you have been touched.
And by that they meant touched by the twin spirits of teaching and music. She might have pursued the latter if her Italian immigrant parents hadn't considered the music industry too shady and debasing.
So they said to me, Dorina, you can teach, but you will not perform.
And teach she did, starting in 1975 as a roaming music instructor at a handful of South Philly schools. If she was more enthusiastic 4 decades ago than she is today, it's hard to imagine how.
It's a sforzando piano crescendo. There is no breath, right? That was on your final, wasn't it?
It was.
Good.
Morrow's taught at the city's premier arts high school for 20 years and seen her fair share of talent. But she had her most famous pupil when she was still a teacher at Meredith School in Queen Village. His name? Nathan Morris.
He told me he wanted to go to South Philadelphia High to play football. I was like, no, you're not going there. Come here. I'm teaching you this audition piece. You're going to Kappa. That's where you're going.
Morris went to Kappa, where he would form the first iteration of Boys to Men. Against her parents' wishes, Morrow also made a side career performing herself as a backup singer for artists such as Michael Bolton and Celine Dion when they rolled through town. And she'll have one more celebrity encounter as she exits. On Saturday, Morrow's students are performing at a city ceremony renaming a part of South Broad Street after, who else? Boys to Men. It's an eerily fitting capstone on a remarkable teaching career. Like most standout educators, Morrow probably could have made more money by becoming an administrator, but she says she couldn't leave the kids.
I have to be near them. They give me life. I mean, it's a wonderful thing when you wake up and you never know what's going to happen, and you can't wait to get to school.
And if her last concert is any indication, school and the kids she taught there will never be far away. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Back in school, we used to dream about this every day. Could it really happen? Would dreams just fade away? When we started singing them, they said it sounds smooth. So we started a group, and here we are, kicking it just for you.
These nights at the Arden Theater in Center City, Philadelphia, a mother is forcing her two girls onto the stage and shouting directions to them as they perform. That might be possible in real life, but in this case, the iconic musical Gypsy has taken over the Arden stage. For WHYY, Howard Shapiro offers this review.
If you're going to take on Gypsy, you'd better have a leading lady with all the chops. That lady doesn't play the daughter who became the gypsy of the title, in real life, the classy stripper Gypsy Rose Lee. In the musical, the leading lady is Mama Rose, and at the Arden, she's played viscerally by the veteran Philadelphia-based actress Mary Martello, who's brought down houses in all sorts of shows for decades on Philadelphia stages. In Gypsy, she's the ultimate stage mother from hell, pushing her two girls into vaudeville across the country to fulfill her dream, always to soar higher. Here's Rose's plan as sung by Martello.
Get yourself some new orchestrations, new routines and red velvet curtains. Get a feathered hat for the baby, photographs in front of the theater. Get an agent, and in jig time, you'll be being booked in the big time. Oh,
the
what
big time.
A dream.
That's the only thing that matters to Mama Rose, whether her daughters want it or not. In the end, vaudeville dies, burlesque takes over, and the rest is a history told by the professional career of Gypsy Rose Lee. The Arden's production hints at a memory play, the story of Mama Rose and her two daughters told from Rose's memories. That's different from the usual Gypsy, as Rose comes onto the stage and looks as if she's recalling events scene by scene. It works until the second act, when director Terrence J. Nolan, who leads the Arden, pretty much drops the device and leaves us hanging. But that's a minor complaint, because overall, the 10-piece orchestra and 21 performers bring off the music by Julie Stein and Stephen Sondheim and the script by Arthur Lorentz in high fashion, with several showstoppers along the way. Rachel Camp plays the daughter who's the apple of Mama Rose's eye, and Caroline Dooner is the less talented daughter who grows up to outshine her mother as Gypsy Rose Lee. The last number in the show has become a linchpin of the American musical. It's called Rose's Turn, when Mama Rose bares her soul, recognizes her self-imposed lifelong enslavement to her daughters, and admits that everything she wanted for the girls was really for her. Martello throws herself into it and proceeds to tear her character's heart out. It's an outstanding performance, the kind that Mama Rose was always trying to elicit from her girls. Gypsy is extended at the Arden through June 25th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.